This week on Amatuse, Winona LaDuke speaks with the Honorable Justice Joe Williams.
This is Winona LaDuke. Our show today, Abatuse, takes place in part in Oxford, England, where I had the opportunity to interview Joe Williams, a court justice in New Zealand, also known as Aotearoa, a court justice of Aotearoa, or New Zealand, who was Maori. Also includes segments of my earlier interviews with Honi Haruira, a Maori member of parliament, and includes some musical selections from New Zealand, Aotearoa. I'm hoping that our listeners can have some interest in hearing about Maori politics, Maori legal institutions, and how other indigenous people reflect their place in civil society in what is known as a settler country like New Zealand. Hope you enjoy the shows today, Miigwech. A few years ago, I went over to Aotearoa or New Zealand, Maori territory, and I had the opportunity to visit with a lot of people over there. Traveled for about 500-600 miles through the territory with Honi Haruira, a leader, a member of parliament. So some of this interview is about that experience and the relationship between him and Joe Williams, who we interviewed today for Abatuse. Over the past 30 years, Maori activists have accomplished much in New Zealand. Maoris now even have a prominent place in the federal government. Of the 122 members of parliament, 8 are Maori, and several Maori have been appointed to various political positions in the government. In a unique political configuration, there are 7 seats in parliament for which only Maori people can vote. And of those 7, 5 are currently held by members of the Maori Party. That was a few years ago. There have been many other achievements. There are around 640,000 Maori in New Zealand, representing maybe a sixth of the population. And of the country's more than 66 million acres, the Maori have almost 4 million acres of communally held land. Maori language knowledge has risen from around 3% fluency to almost 100% knowledge, and it's estimated that 30% of the Maoris are fluent speakers. You see that in radio and in TV, where they have a Maori television network, which produces news in Maori as well as Maori radio stations that serve the Maori community and the non-Maori community, because increasing numbers of Kiwis, or people from New Zealand actually, are interested and speak Maori as the first or second language. There are more than 100 language immersion schools in Maori, and there are some 50 tribal communities of Maori with various community development corporations, including the Maori Media Empire, radio, print, and TV. One of my longtime colleagues and friends, Honi Haruira, one of the most prominent Maori activists, told me, "You can't get anything without a fight. You always have to fight to gain." Haruira is one of the longest-standing members of the New Zealand Parliament representing the Maori Party, now representing a new party. His electorate is in the far north of New Zealand, or Aotearoa, including his home community of Kaitaia. I met him in 1983 when he came to the International Indian Treaty Council meeting in Okmulgee, Oklahoma. Became fast friends largely because I was his most reliable ride. I took him on a road trip of a couple of thousand miles of Indian country. He's a passionate activist and has had many battles on behalf of the Maori people, the Treaty of Waitangi, protesting for Maori environmental and land rights. And he also faced a long legal battle because of his support of the South African anti-apartheid movement. But at least that resulted in him meeting Bishop Desmond Tutu. And that was the freakiest experience of my life, Haruira said. This story starts in 1981 when Honi Haruira, my friend, was arrested while protesting the visit of the South African Springboks, that country, South Africa's national rugby team. You can see the movie Invictus, starring Matt Damon and Morgan Freeman, for a dramatized version of the Springbok story. Haruira was charged with 96 years worth of felonies for participating in riots opposing the Springboks. Those felonies include participating in a riot and assault with intent to cause grievous bodily harm. The case went on for a couple of years, Haruira told me, but when the date for his trial was finally set, Haruira had an epiphany. He had to get South African Bishop Desmond Tutu to come to New Zealand at the invitation of the Anglican Church to talk about apartheid. Haruira would then request that Tutu testify at his trial as an expert witness. Haruira's mother was active in the Anglican Church and she spoke to Tutu. The trial started. Faced with 96 years, there were 10 defendants, but Haruira elected to defend himself. That's some faith. He delivered his testimony to the jury. As he was winding down, he recalled there was a head poking in the back of the courtroom. "This is one of my colleagues. He nods to me as I'm sitting on the witness stand completing my testimony." At that point, the judge asked Haruira if he had any witnesses to bring forth. He said he did, and he called Desmond Tutu to the stand. A short time later, Haruira and his 9 defendants were all acquitted of charges. A standing ovation was given to Desmond Tutu. It's 28 years later and Harawira is still an uncompromising leader. Here's some of its thoughts on political activism, shared by the likes of Joe Williams. Maori strategies. Compromise your strategies, not your principles. Be bold in your positions. When governments say the Maori need to be realistic, what they are really saying is no. But that shouldn't make us afraid to say what our people want and commit ourselves to doing the best to achieve that. If we're not successful, then don't let it be because we let somebody else stop us from daring to succeed. On literacy, the Maori people drafted a Declaration of Independence in 1835. 5 years later, the Treaty of Waitangi was signed, recognizing Maori sovereignty, rights to natural resources and land. At that time, the Maori were more literate than the Pakeha, the non-native settlers. Treaties were written in Maori and interpreted in Maori for the people. Today, 100% of the Maori are largely bilingual. Maori is one of three official languages of New Zealand. It's Maori, English, and sign language. On indigenous people and working in mainstream politics, you can get knowledge anywhere, even from the enemy. If we're talking about sovereignty, we want to run a country, we have to know how to manage a country. There are concessions to be made, but substantive change doesn't come through national politics, not unless your leadership is courageous.
This is Winona, and I found a judge. I don't know a lot of indigenous judges. You wear a wig?
Only on very special occasions.
Okay, so you're a Maori judge.
I am.
Joe Williams, Maori judge.
Correct.
Wow, that's pretty interesting. So,
not really.
I think it's pretty interesting. So, okay, first of all, so I'm just visiting for my community at home. Maoris are what, 10%, 20%, 30% of the population in New Zealand?
So currently 16%, 630,000 out of a population of 4 million. So by Anglo-colonial standards, the largest indigenous minority. If you're looking across the US, Canada, Australia and New Zealand, Maoris are the kind of largest indigenous group.
That's an interesting thing to start with, because we're a very small percentage in the US, but in some areas we're a large percentage.
Yeah.
Like Navajo or northern Minnesota, arguably.
Right. Yep.
But overall, because your country has 4 million people, mm-hmm. you guys are 670,000 or so?
650,000.
650,000 Maori people.
Yeah.
Very interesting. So I heard you talk today quite a bit. I mean, not quite a bit, but a chunk. I enjoyed it quite a bit. But how long have you been a judge?
So I was made chief judge of the Maori Land Court in 2000, and chairperson of the Waitangi Tribunal in 2004. So the Maori Land Court is, in US terms, think of it as the tribe with the court with exercising tribal jurisdiction. Probably, it's the closest equivalent you'd get.
Tribal jurisdiction over
Maori land, so land owned by Maori kin groups. And then in the Waitangi Tribunal, we are the sort of roving commission that deals with claims that the state has breached Maori rights under the Treaty of Waitangi in the past, under the treaty that created our country. And then in 2008, at the end of 2008, I became a Justice of the High Court in New Zealand. So now I exercise general jurisdiction in the High Court. And so I'm not a judge anymore, I'm a justice.
And so you're a justice and you exercise jurisdiction over Maori and non-Maori people?
Correct.
Are there other Maori judges in that position?
There are two of us.
Wow.
Justice Christian Fata and myself.
I don't actually... Well, there are some of the lower courts that are native, but...
There are lots of Maori judges in the lower courts. It's probably... 7 or 8 in the district court. I don't know what the equivalent is in the US. And then there are that many again in the Maori Land Court, which is the court I used to head. Most of the judges in the Maori Land Court are Maori. But once you get up into the higher courts, the numbers get pretty thin.
So what's the equivalent in the States? Is the federal court system?
The federal, kind of, except that because there's no federal system... it's the federal, it's kind of a mix of the federal and state court system. So the High Court deals with serious crime, serious commercial disputes over a particular value, and any actions brought against the state itself, against the country itself. So if it's anything that's serious comes through my court. And then there's a court of appeal above me and a Supreme Court above that.
Okay, I gotcha. I think so. It'd be like the federal court, then the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. So you're like the federal court, Eighth
Circuit. I'm like the federal court, but we're like the federal court and the state Supreme Court rolled into one.
All right.
Because there's no federal state. There's only one country and no state system.
Right. I don't actually know that we have quite the equivalent, but...
There's no equivalent.
Right. So it's a really interesting thing because, you know, I was interested to visit with you about it because there's not a lot of that. Just as a little bit of background, you were talking earlier a little bit about it, but Maori people, like Native people in the U.S., are pretty heavily implicated in the justice system, not in a good way. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, Maoris are the most charged and most incarcerated group in the country by a long shot. So our statistics, if you're a Maori, so 50% of the prison population is Maori, although we're only 15% of the population. If you're a Maori, you're six times more likely to be apprehended and charged than a non-Maori. You are 11 times more likely, if you are apprehended and charged, to be remanded in custody rather than bailed. And if you are charged and go to trial, you are 7.5 times more likely to be sent to prison. So the Maori imprisonment rate is about 7 times higher than the non-Maori imprisonment rate.
So I think earlier you said 50% of the people in prison are Maori.
50% of the men and 60% of the women in prison at any one time are Maori, even though we're a much smaller percentage of the population.
So let me try to think this through, because it's analogous, but it's not. It's a colonial country. You're a larger percentage of the population. You have not the same thing as reservations, but something like that, right?
There's no reservation system.
You have territories, though, right?
Well, there are certainly tribal territories. The entire country is split up into tribal territories, but the tribes no longer own the territory. They own small bits of the territory, the leftover, the residue of what followed the colonial acquisition mostly in the 19th century. So in New Zealand, because the tribes were so powerful militarily and politically during the 19th century...
When the Pākehā or the non...
When the non-natives arrived, when the English arrived. The way... And there was a major war fought over about 15 or 20 years between the settlers and Māori. And what happened after that was the state dealt with the problem of the Māori presence by ignoring the existence of the tribe and individualizing all titles.
So like allotment?
Kind of like the Dawes Allotment Act in 1880, whatever it is in the States.
1889.
Right, yeah. But except that you didn't actually get an allotment. What you got was scrip. So you got a piece of paper saying you were entitled to a certain percentage as an individual of a tribal allocation, and that was freely tradable. So it took about 30 years for most of the country to disappear out of Maori hands.
It was alienated.
Well, significant areas were confiscated as in payment for the war, and the areas that weren't confiscated...
The war between the Maoris and the Pākehā.
And the British Crown.
The British.
So several million acres were alienated in payment for that war, and what remained went through what was called the Native Land Court, the historical predecessor of the Maori Land Court, in which all of the Maori interests were individualized, but not into allotments, so you didn't actually own a 10-acre block or 30-acre block or whatever it is on a piece of land. You owned a percentage. And that percentage, that piece of paper that you held, your scrip, was freely alienable. So what happened was the state went behind the tribes or under the tribes or around the tribes to the individuals and said, if you give me that piece of paper, I will give you some money. The result of which was, over about a 30-year period from 1865 to the turn of the 20th century, almost all of the Māori land base was lost.
So I watched this movie, Utu. Is that what it was called?
Utu, yeah, yeah.
Classic.
Yeah, it's a great movie, yeah.
Kind of like a Sitting Bull kind of guy, yeah?
Yeah. So that character is modelled on an actual revolutionary fighter called Te Kōti, who fought a war against the British Crown from about 1868 through to about 1870. And then he escaped into the interior of the North Island and was never caught. And he founded a religion called Ringatū, which is still a very strong religion in New Zealand today, with about 10 or 15,000 adherents.
He was never caught.
He was never caught.
That's a great story. We like those stories. Yeah, really, Utu, U-T-U.
That's right. Utu means payment.
Payment, yeah. Introducing the haka and the all blacks, the haka being one of the most amazing forms of articulating your spiritual and musical experience. For those listening in, Swinola Duke, I'm talking to Joe Williams, and it's an interesting movie. It's a good instructive movie of a period. But, you know, so when I was interested in talking to you about this, a little bit of history for our people. I have the privilege of being over there, but I don't know that much about your territory, but there's a difference in, I mean, there's a similar colonial history. You guys have a higher population.
A higher percentage, actually not a higher population, but a higher percentage of the national population.
You're probably more like the Canadian North, where there's a majority population is native in a lot of areas.
Yeah, the Māori Pākehā or Māori non-Māori kind of relationship, the Māori relationship with non-Māori in New Zealand is a little bit like a mix of the English-French relationship in Canada combined with the Canadian First Nations relationship. It's a combination of those two things.
How is that?
Because we're a big proportion of, a biggish proportion of the population, we have a certain political clout. And because we're indigenous, we have indigenous rights as well. So that it's a combination of the kind of French-English relationship in Canada as well as the indigenous relationship with the Crown.
And just for those listening in, I was privileged enough to be with Honi Harawira, who's a member of Parliament.
He is.
You have a number of members of Parliament that are Maori, a number of ministers that are Maori. Yeah? You have do you have a Maori party?
Right, so...
You have judges. I mean, you're kind of entrenched.
That's right, actually. So there's 120 members of... 122, something like that, members of Parliament in my country, of whom about 20 are Maori. And some are in the mainstream parties, Labour, which is the Democrats, National, which is the Republicans, although actually the parties in our country are all well to the left of the Democrats and the Republicans. And then there is a Māori party and a Mana party, both of whom represent specifically the Māori constituency, along with a number of other parties. So Māori are very present in the national political scene. And the Māori tribal leadership has direct access, really, to the apex of power in our state in a way that
is not possible in Australia, Canada, or the US, driven really only by the size of this minority.
So just to go back on that, you are entrenched in the settler government.
Correct.
If that's what we're going to call it, which Correct. Is now the national government
Correct.
Of Aotearoa.
Correct.
Your nation. And then you also have your own nations or constituencies there.
Right.
Not quite like reservations, but you have political leadership that is in these communities too.
Yes, that's right. So there's a tribal system sits on top of the legal system, separate from it.
And on top 50, of lands too.
And on top of lands. 50 or 60 tribes. The largest of them, Ngāpuhi, is 120-odd thousand. The smaller ones, like my tribe, Ngāti Pūkenga, are 2,000 or 3,000. And that there's no reservation system that they operate out of, but they exist, to be honest, they exist in the hearts and minds of the people, so they're very real to the people. And since the treaty settlement process has gone through and there's been reparations made for the wrongs committed during the colonial era, the tribes, for the first time really in the last 20 years or so, for the first time in our history, have become resourced enough to make an impact themselves. Because in the past, tribes were just ignored because it wasn't convenient to recognise them. Because if you recognise tribes, you stopped colonisation.
Oh, bummer, huh?
Yeah. So now the tribes... colonisation is, of course, a fait accompli, but the tribes now are significant political and economic players for the first time since the colonial era. And that's changed the nature of politics and the nature of power distribution in the country.
So within that, so for instance, like historically in Indian communities, I always call it underdeveloping. That means what other people keep taking your assets.
Yeah.
Right? You know, whether it's your water, your grazing rights, your mineral resources. Tribes are struggling to get control over those now. You guys have more control over those.
I wouldn't say that. I don't think that's right. The iwi, as we call them, the tribes back home, are developing some control for the first time. So we are really at the beginnings of tribal development, whereas native people in the US and in Canada have been doing this for a long time. So what's different about us is that we are starting to do this, whereas for 100 years, the tribe has been ignored except by our own people. So the tribe has existed only in the hearts and minds of the people because the law has either fought to destroy the tribe or at best ignored it. So no reservation system, no recognition of tribal leaders, of, you know, chiefs appointed to be heads of nations and so on, none of that. So Māori's only existed in law as individuals, but the tribe survived only in the hearts and minds of the people. And now in the modern era, the state has really accepted that the tribes were not crushed and did not die in the colonial process and must now be properly recognised if there is to be a just readjustment in the postmodern time. So the tribes are just beginning to find their strength.
So, yeah, I mean, it'd be kind of hard to ignore if there's 650,000 of you.
Yeah, that's right.
It's kind of looking like you're there.
Yeah.
Particularly if there's only 4 million people, but then...
But you see, it's 650,000 who have not forgotten who they are.
Right. I mean, that's the other thing that is really important about Maori people is that, you know, I know that you have the marae and you have your language. And, you know, I mean, because a lot of Native people are struggling with language restoration in North America, but the model is the nest model that came out of Maori because... Wasn't it like 30 or 40 years ago that there were very few speakers?
That's right. So in the 70s and 80s, the Māori language fell to about 60,000 speakers, of whom only a few hundred were under the age of 5. So unless something serious was done, the Māori language would die in a generation because the little ones no longer spoke Māori except for a few hundred. So Māoris themselves, government ended up supporting it with funding eventually, but Māori, in the beginning, Māoris themselves developed things called language nests, kōangareo, to raise children under five in te reo Māori, in the Māori language. And then they developed schools called kura kaupapa Māori. Then they developed secondary schools called kura tuarua. And then they developed Māori universities called whare wānanga. So over the last 30 years, there's been a kind of vertical construction of an education system in the Māori language that never existed before, the effect of which was that there's now about 160,000 speakers of Māori. Out of the 600,000, about 160,000 speak Māori, many of them at the younger age rather than at the older age. And interestingly, most interestingly in my view, most powerfully, 30,000 non-speakers of Māori. Sorry, 30,000 non-Māori speakers of Māori.
That's really interesting.
That in many ways, that's the most powerful number of all. So you've got 30,000 New Zealanders who are not Māori who have come to speak Māori as a result of this revolution.
So you start with very few speakers, and then you kept building it.
That's right.
That's that, you know, the nest system. And so just one more time, what you said is that you actually have universities or colleges that are in Māori.
And Māori run, that's right.
And Māori run.
Yeah.
Because I think even our tribal colleges are generally in English in the U.S., although language is an important component. But language, you know, I find it interesting because while our tribes have federal recognition for many years in the United States or in Canada, status, non-status, treaty, non-treaty, residential, whatever, you guys did not have recognition, but you had your language.
That's right. So back home, the Māori revival, I suppose, you might call it that, from the 70s on, that sort of picked up off the back of the American Civil Rights Movement, the Indian version of that in the US, all of that stuff, and our own baby boom, because we grew population-wise from a very small proportion of the population. We bred like rabbits for 50
That's
years.
That's nice to know.
Yeah. It's a great strategy, let me tell you. From, 40,000 people in 1880, our population fell from 200,000 in Cook's time, in Captain Cook's time, to 40,000. So, sort of 75% kill rate. From that to 650,000 now. Where was I taking that?
We're talking about language and power and political jurisdiction.
We were. So the population grew. Sorry, I'm just forgetting where I'm going.
You have a great amount of political power, but it came from your people. Your people were recognized as individuals, but now they're recognized politically as nations and tribes as well as individuals. Is that right?
That's right. So there's a kind of dual citizenship for Māori now. There is the ability, the citizenship of your tribe and citizenship of the country. And there are, there are Māori seats in the parliament, Māori-specific seats, not just Māori politicians, but Māori constituencies. There are eight of those. And there are about 20 Māori politicians in the legislature, identifiably Māori, who sort of espouse Māori causes, although they belong right across the
spectrum.
They're
just racially Māori.
They're Māori, that's right.
Yeah.
So the country is really working out now, just now, over the last few years, the nature of the relationship between the traditional tribes and the modern individualized political system, and how they should operate one to the other. So this ancient system and this modern system dancing around one another at a bit of a distance, trying to work out what the steps of the dance are.
Yeah, and you're kind of in the middle of that, I suppose, because you're in the federal court, or in the court, high court, yeah?
Mm.
But you came from the land court.
Yeah, so, and judges are a little bit in the middle of that, yeah.
Yeah, and earlier when you were talking, I found it very interesting, you're talking about how in Aotearoa, Now they sing in Maori as well as in English, yeah?
The national anthem?
The national anthem.
Yes. So there are a lot of ways in which New Zealand's national identity has come to adopt and co-opt Maori identity to express its own nationalism. So singing the national anthem in Maori.
The All Blacks.
The All Blacks doing the haka, the war dance in.
Because those guys are not all Maori, although there are a number of Maoris.
There are plenty of Maoris in it, but they're not.
It's
a national team. It's the national rugby team, which is
terrifying to look at and daunting and awesome.
It's pretty cool, but the cool thing about it is that not just the Maoris do it well; they all know how to do the haka well. So there's lots of examples of the adoption of Maori iconic cultural tags to express national identity. So something quite fundamental has changed really in the last generation in terms of the respectability of being Maori. And that's been very positive, I think, because, you know, in my childhood, that simply was not the case. This is a very new thing.
Yeah. That is an interesting thing to watch. And I just observed a little bit, but I noticed your power, you know, as a people. And yet at the same time, it's, you know, a challenge because obviously when the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People was passed, Australia, New Zealand, the US,
and Canada
did not support the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People despite us 2000 and, you know, just 2007, yeah?
That's right.
Yeah. And so in spite of the fact that it's cool to be Maori and cool for New Zealand to have Maoris, they took them a while to come around to that one, yeah?
Well, you know, race and settler Maori relationships have always been a very big hot button issue in my country, and they still are. That issue still is. And if you're thinking of a US equivalent, it's a lot like a mix between Native and Black American relationships with the wider nation state. It's kind of a mix of those two things.
Because
the numbers
blacks,
are roughly...
Black Americans have a percentage.
Yeah, roughly, 10, 15%?
That's a good point.
Yeah.
So and then there's a political power of tribes.
That's right. So there's a tribal dimension and an individualized minority of colour dimension to the way in which Maori relate to the wider New Zealand. What's different is that wider New Zealand now needs the Maori culture to express itself, to make itself different.
To be cool, not just another British colonial outpost.
Just not another Australia or another Canada or another America. So it's
kind of, to be a Kiwi also means to be proud of
Kiwis when they go overseas.
Kiwis being
New Zealanders, yeah. If they all get together, you know, they'll sing a song as they often do. That itself a Maori thing, you know, they'll sing a Maori song.
Really?
Yeah. White people will sing a Maori song because that's how they differentiate themselves. You know,
someone thinks they're Australian, huh?
That's right, exactly. So they'll sing po kare kare ana ngā wai o roto rua, whiti atu koe hine Māori no ana e, which is a Māori song. So there is an element of the Central or South American indigenization of national identity.
Indigenization of national identity.
That's right. It's the kind of mestizo thing going on, right? And New Zealand's working its way through the price of indigenization of national identity, how much it's prepared to pay for the co-option of Maori identity. That ambivalence, that embrace of Maori cultural icons, yet ambivalence around Maori poverty and criminality is the issue that we are dancing around now. Still not resolved.
So How do you see that proceeding forward? I mean, they did pass the Declaration on the Rights, but I'm not
they
sure.
Did. Yeah, yeah. They
I'm ended not up sure how the UNDRIP. I think that's a funny acronym, isn't it? UNDRIP.
That's right.
Like someone should have thought that one through.
This is Winona LaDuke and Abba Toussaint. Bizin done. We're going to put on some music, and then we'll be back. Introducing some of the music for our show, Catch a Fire, is a Maori reggae band. Really amazing reggae music and representing a lot of the mainstream Maori music, which is, in fact, reggae. Miigwech for listening.
Yeah.
UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, UNDRIP, for those listening in. As that was finally passed, I still am not clear how that's applied.
And I don't think that it is clear in New Zealand how it will be applied or how powerful it will be at all. I think that's still to be worked through, and it's going to be an important thread in the working out of the wider relationship between Māori and the nation state in this new New Zealand in which the Māori dimension has become so important. So UNDRIP is there, the Treaty of Waitangi is there, there is ongoing ambivalence around inequality between Māori and non-Māori.
And that's economic, to some extent, economic, political, social, and certainly in terms of the judicial
that's
system.
Right, that's right. All of that. You know, the statistics that would apply. That's right. The statistics that would apply to Indigenous Americans or African Americans apply in some form or another to Maori New Zealanders. But there is this new dimension, this new approach that has developed quite organically. No politician has stood up and said, this is the way we're going to make this happen. It's just happened that way, driven off demographic change and strong Māori leadership.
So I get this feeling of kind of a political goodwill.
Well, there's I wouldn't overstate that.
Okay, I just being optimistic.
Yeah, my problem is I'm an eternal optimist. I'm always looking.
I'm with you, buddy.
I'm always looking for the bright side. Otherwise, you know, you just get plain depressed.
Or crabby.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Crabby. I'm crabby enough as it is. So I wouldn't overstate that. There are huge problems. Huge problems. And some of those problems continue to be intractable, including problems around Māori economic performance and Māori criminality. But there is a different wind around now. And it seems to me that there is the prospect that in the next generation we might look forward to a time when Māori aren't the most jailed, the most poor, the most sick, the most unemployed, the most uneducated group in the country anymore. It's going to take a generation, but it seems to me for the first time since colonisation itself, it's possible to think about Māori leadership and Māori cohesion being sufficient to overcome what has in the past been the most intractable problem of our entire post-colonial history.
So, and without, I know you have some other things to do, but, you know, is on one hand, and you're in kind of a unique situation. You guys are way down under there. I mean, just to point out something which is geographically obvious, right? You're kind of a small but mighty country, right?
Small, I wouldn't say mighty, we're small.
Small. Maoris are a daunting bunch, though. And basically, it's seeming to, like, what I'm trying to figure out is, are you suggesting that are Maori people going to have to integrate into New Zealand, or is New Zealand going to indigenize and become more Maori?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head. Maori people are integrated into New Zealand. Because we have no reservation system, no separate tribal jurisdiction, Maori and non-Maori live cheek by jowl all over the country. Yet the villages, the marais, the traditional meeting houses, the tribes and the sub-tribes and the extended families have lived on and refused to die. And that is a great judgment of history. That is the case.
Tough bunch.
I think so. Bless them all. So there is a level of integration that makes negotiating between the races easier than it might be elsewhere. And the numbers mean that there is power there that isn't there elsewhere. And the question is whether the Māori leadership and the national leadership have the vision to find a way of producing, of making stronger both sides in that equation over the next generation. Actually, we don't know the answer to that yet. This game is far from over. It could go either way still.
And it's not to say, like, I don't know necessarily what the term social experiment.
Exactly.
But this thing is it's like you got a settler society that came into an indigenous nation, you know, and you guys are trying to figure it out. You got numbers, you got some political power, you have a lot of the same bags all around that they carried and that we get.
Mm. Yeah.
Right? But, you know, you guys look like, I mean, in Canada, there's some places where they're, like in Nunavut,
right?
You know, where you have an indigenous leadership.
Quite significant power and leadership, yeah.
Right, in northern Canada. Mm. In the United States, you have some native people elected in New Mexico and Arizona.
Yeah, where they're very powerful.
Some in Montana. Mm. You know, Maine has 2 seats on the legislature, and maybe 4 now that are reserved for indigenous First Nations.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yes, very interesting political model.
Okay.
You know, and I often think that I live in Minnesota, and I think there are 11 tribes. We should have 11 seats at the legislature so that you can have a forum for dialogue in the state.
That's right. It's good for the country or the state to have an indigenous voice there.
In the system that is just, you don't got to fight for it.
That's right.
It's there.
Access to power.
And then you have your own, because we didn't ask to be dual citizens. You know, we didn't ask for everything, right? So, you know, it is this interesting how you're going to make it work. And so I find that the model there is very interesting. I mean, from what I've seen, and, you know, my opportunity to be there is limited, and it's been very privileged, you know, but I like the, you know, I like the idea. I like, and I like the indigeneity or, you know, the indigenizing of the country. I mean, I find it interesting when Juani Harawira, I believe, one of the longest standing members of parliament, that's Maori, is that correct?
I'm not sure, but he's certainly been there for 3 or 4 terms.
Yeah, a while.
Yeah.
And he's a very tough nationalist.
He sure is.
You know, he's not a what we call sellout.
That's right, he's no pussy.
Yeah, he's not selling out anytime. Very tough guy, and I knew him many years ago. And I believe that the last time he was elected, he wanted to give his whole speech in Maori. Right?
Probably.
Yeah.
It doesn't surprise me.
And they want him to have the crown and the guy with the big, I don't know, big fancy things there, yeah? To swear him in. You know what I'm talking about.
Right, this is about the swearing of allegiance to Her Majesty.
And he didn't want to swear.
He didn't want to do that. He wanted to swear allegiance to the Treaty of Waitangi, which is the treaty that established
it. It was very contentious.
It was very contentious, that's right.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it was an interesting political moment. Mm-hmm. Because the Queen is not really in New Zealand, but the treaty is the agreement between your ancestors and their ancestors, yeah?
Correct.
Kia piripono me te tino āmene atu ki te Tiriti o Waitangi. Kia pono ki aro nui aku mahi. Kia ahu whakamua ai ngā tika o ngai o te Taitokerau. Kia whakapaua e ahau.
Order.
Aku kaha
Order.
Katoa.
Order. That is not the affirmation required by law. Hone Harawira will now leave the chamber and return to this chamber on a sitting day when he is prepared to make his affirmation according to the law of this land. The member, the Hone Harawira, will now leave the chamber.
Mea rawa ake.
Kia tū motu hake.
The member will now leave the chamber.
E rangatira o tēnei whenua.
Engari mo tēnā, e ai ki te māngai whakatumatuma. E ai ki te ture, me whakapūmaunga me mapāre mata katoa I te oati ki te kuini o Ingarangi. Engari pērā I ngā tau ki muri, ka whakamātau tonu ētahi ki te tuku I ā rātau oati ki te tiriti o Waitangi. I te whare pāre mata ngā kai tautoko I ā Harawira, ka rongo hia tō rātau reo taunaki.
I ask visitors please to respect this house.
Mūrawa ke ngā reo Waiata, ka putanga whakamārama a te kaiwhakahaere o te whare.
I did not make this decision lightly, that there has been a tendency in recent times to abuse our law. It's not just a custom in this house, it is the law of this country. And Hone Harawira was advised of the need to comply with the law.
Aha kua ngā mahi I rō whare, ka puta a Harawira ki waho, ki āna kai tautoko.
So it'll be interesting to see how that goes over time.
Yes, it will. And those symbols, the symbol of the Oath of Allegiance, the symbol of the language that is spoken in the House of Representatives, the symbol of the culture of the ceremonies that open the legislature and close the legislature, open the courts and close the courts, those symbols are very important. Not in themselves, but as
national symbols.
As thermometers of what's going on underneath. That they tell you something about the temperature. And there's a lot of progress being made in Māori co-option of those symbols right now. And my belief, and
Is it a bilingual country?
It struggles to be a bilingual country.
My belief is that being an eternal optimist, that the co-option of those symbols is a reflection of an underlying shift in temperature. And that's the thing you need to understand. It's not a bilingual country yet, but it could be. Whereas 20 years ago, when I started out in this struggle, it couldn't be. Now it could be.
And, you know, just in closing, and actually to backtrack a little bit, I had a couple of interesting things that I thought I learned. I mean, I have a couple observations. One is that a difference between Maori people and, for instance, Ojibwe people, 5 states, 4 Canadian provinces, that's our territory, right?
Mm. 5 states?
Oh, yeah. Northern part of 5 American states, southern part of 4 Canadian provinces.
Wow, that's a big area.
No kidding. Bigger than Aotearoa.
By miles.
My theory is that, not that we aren't as tough as you guys, but you guys had to fight like hell because you were an island. And so you guys, like, full on fought it out.
Sure did.
Right? And we would, I think from our territory, we're serious fighters, no question. But we could say, hey, we're going to give it a break. We see you guys in a few months, okay? Just take a chill. You understand what I'm saying? Like, yeah. Socially and politically and in your how you fight, you guys never had a space to go to.
That's right. It's a small place.
Yeah. I mean, you could go to Hawaii. No, that's 3,000 miles.
Yeah.
You know?
That's right.
You know, and so you have to work it out.
We just had the 150th anniversary of the great battles of the Waikato War, the first phase of the New Zealand Wars. And on the 29th of April, so that's 20 days ago or so, was the 150th anniversary of the battle of what's called the Battle of Gate Pa, where my great-great-grandfather fought against the British Crown. There were 2,000 Imperial troops fresh from the Crimean War.
The last one.
Not the last one, yeah. Not the Putin Crimean War, the other one, where the British were fighting the Russians. And fighting 230 Maoris, so 2,000 against 230. And the Maoris sprung a trap and caught them in a killing ground and routed the British army.
Holy buckets. You pounded them, huh?
In the space of about 10 seconds, the British lost 110. It was just a beautifully, we don't have time to talk about it, but it was a beautifully sprung trap. And the 41st Regiment and the 68th Regiment of the British Army were so embarrassed that they tried to cover it up. Anyway, 150th anniversary of that terrible battle that led to the confiscation of much of my family's land was had just 20 days ago, and the British Army turned up, and the New Zealand Army, and 1,000 Maori warriors, male and female, men and women, stripped and armed with spears and clubs and guns, came together to recognise that event 150 years ago. And it was one of the great moments of my life to see that happen as my relations roared their defiance at the military forces of the British once again 150 years later. And it made me think that there is great hope for the survival of this beautiful culture, this beautiful language, and these great warrior people.
Yeah, I think you guys are pretty tough looking.
No, not that tough, really.
Yeah. Just to clarify for me, I heard, I think Hone told me, Hone Haruia told me, that at the time of the negotiation of the Treaty of Waitangi,
mm-hmm.
which was what year?
1840.
Mm-hmm. Many of the Maoris were more educated than many of the Europeans who had come to New Zealand.
That's right. Not more educated, they were more literate.
You guys,
so the Maori literacy in Maori, in the Maori language in 1840, was much higher than settler literacy because they were all, you know, they were
poor people from
That's right. They were the oppressed from
from England. London and Scotland. Not many Irish, but there were a few Irish. So they were all illiterate, whereas the Maoris had learned to read the Bible in Maori. So there was a high level of Maori literacy.
So that moment, I mean, I guess that that is a form of power in itself, that you all were more literate than the settlers who came.
What that, it's interesting, you know, that time, because although colonization was fateful and to some extent fatal, we have to realize what a revolution the introduction of literacy and technology was, and what a flowering of some aspects of my culture occurred as a result of that, like written exchanges between chiefs that would never have occurred in the past, philosophical treatises being written down for the first time that in the past were oral, and the engagement in trade, you know, in cultivation and livestock and so on, all of the sorts of things that happened in the US as well. So that, you know, the early days of colonization were not necessarily a negative experience. They became a negative experience later once the white man decided he just wanted to steal all the land. But in the early days, literacy and technology actually produced a revolutionary change in our own cultures for good, with powerful effects on the way tribes saw themselves, you know, and the growth of new, you know, the sprouting of offshoots in Maori philosophy and political dialogue, political discourse within the tribes, and technological, you know, the gaining of technological advantage. One of the reasons why the chiefs wanted to sign the Treaty of Waitangi was they wanted to trade with the British colonies offshore, because, you know, there was money in it. So if you could fly a British flag, you didn't have to pay custom duties. It was cold, hard,
realism. Negotiating.
That's right, shrewdness, real shrewdness.
Agency.
Yeah, all of the sorts of things you saw with the way the Iroquois dealt with the British, or the Cherokee dealt with the Americans before things turned bad and the inevitable result occurred.
I don't know if it's inevitable in all cases, but in our cases, historically, it was
inevitable. That's right.
And
but it wasn't necessarily like that at the start.
It's like trade. I'm not opposed to trade. I just want it fair.
That's right. Yeah.
And at that time, it was a fair moment before greed and whatever took over. Yeah.
Yeah. Before they decided that the U.S. and New Zealand and Australia and Canada were the places that they would empty the unwanted from the British Isles. Before that, this was the meeting up with Western culture was a time of enormous creativity and change amongst our cultures as we grabbed the best of those things that we thought would work for us and made them work for us. You know, it was the good side of globalization for a decade or two decades before it turned bad.
You know, I had a moment about 3 weeks ago. I was in Washington, D.C., and I was standing in opposition to this big pipeline called the Keystone, which we really don't like. I was at my teepee. I had a teepee on the Washington Mall.
Oh, yeah.
It was a great moment politically. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I walked out of my teepee, and I got in a Tesla. Exactly. I like this. You know what I'm saying? Is that not all things are bad.
Yeah.
It's just the terms of the trade. And I want to move into a Tesla. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I like some things that we have.
Mm.
I just want them on our terms.
Mm.
And that's one of the things that interests me so much about your country.
It's control of the process.
Yeah.
Control of the process.
You guys have
the secret.
Agency and control.
Not yet, not yet.
You're working on it.
But that's right. But we see a time when we might have. Of course, we could screw it up. But we see a time where we might have.
Yeah. Hmm. Hang in there.
Kia ora.
Kia ora. Kia ora. Thank you. Good.
This has been Abatusa on Niji Radio, KKWE 89.9 FM, White Earth, Minnesota.